Hello, everyone. Good evening for those of our participants in Asia. Good late afternoon for those of us who are dialing in from Africa, from the Middle East, from Europe. And good day for those of us like myself who are dialing in from the United States. I'm very excited today to have the presentation of this research project that has resulted in a forthcoming book, The Great Demographic Reversal, by my esteemed colleague, Professor Charles Goodhart, and his esteemed co-author, Manoj Pradhan. Charles Goodhart is, well, the most famous finance professor, maybe more than that, at the London School of Economics for many years, and also the founder of the Financial Markets Group at the London School of Economics, where I also work. Charles established the Financial Markets Group some 30 years ago also, and has done work in many areas of finance, including banking mostly. He's one of the few economists or actually social scientists who has a law named after him, Goodhart's law. So let's see whether that comes up in the discussion today. His co-author Manoj Pradhan also has a very established and esteemed career, leading him to be the founder of independent consultancy, Talking Heads Macroeconomics. Before that, however, he had prominent careers in a number of large financial institutions, including in Morgan Stanley, but several others. We will hear from them on what brought them together for this perspective of where the world economy and society, I would say, not just the world economy is going. This is a presentation of the Financial Markets Group. As you've seen the presentation, there are a number of thoughts, ideas in this book, in this research project, that relate to the development of the financial sector and how it can support the working of the global economy. But there are many, many other ideas as well. And as you see in the title itself, demography plays a very significant role in the narrative that we are about to hear. We will hear from Professor Goodhart first, and then from his co-author next, or they are free to go back and forth between themselves. So we'll first hear the presentation, and then I'll be curating your comments. I'll try to group them in terms of substance, so we have a more more engaging discussion. So please send us comments through the chat as you listen in. I'll have time then to look at them in advance and pass them to our esteemed colleagues and presenters. With this, please, Charles, Professor Goodhart, welcome virtually to the Financial Markets Group, which you established many years ago. Thank you from all of us who've worked with you for all of these years. And please, we're very interested to hear about your new project. Charles.
Thank you very much, Simeon. And thank you for your introduction. The only thing that I would marginally correct is our book is no longer forthcoming. It actually has already come forth. So anyone who wants to buy one can do so now. Now, with that, can I turn to the first slide, please? Manoj, can you? Thank you very much. I'd like to start by reminding you how extraordinary, from a monetary point of view, the last 70 years has been since about 1950. Before then, the longer term development of prices remained fairly stable and was expected to do so, even when in the short term prices moved around a lot in the earlier years because of the vagaries of climate and the harvest, and from time to time, wartime. But even then, you can see that despite the wars, the Napoleonic Wars, World War I, and so on, there was never any such a large change in expectations of inflation and in nominal interest rates expected, as particularly at the long end, as there has been since 1950, when we had two really extraordinarily persistent and large trends, first upwards and then downwards. And since these are nominal monetary phenomena, it is obviously related to nominal monetary factors. But one has to think of the context in which the money supply initially was allowed to rise enough to accommodate the rising inflation and then reverse. In the earlier years from 1950 to 1980, this was largely because of a well-intentioned attempt by the authorities, the politicians of the time, to run our economies using Keynesian type models and Keynesian type policies at a level of unemployment, initially trying to maintain unemployment around 2 to 2.5%, which for a variety of reasons became untenable. The authorities then tried prices and incomes policies, and that didn't work. And then eventually in 1979-81, you got Paul Volcker's measures to monetary measures to bring about a sharp change in inflation. Since then, of course, monetary policy has been vastly improved with central bank independence, and with that also inflation targetry. Nevertheless, it hasn't been, in some sense, all that difficult for the authorities to achieve their inflation target, as represented by the fact that over the years from 1991, which was about when inflation targetry came in, until 2007, the trend of nominal interest rates, long and short, was steadily downwards. And after the great financial crisis, despite all the expansionary efforts of central banks, they were not able even to hit their inflation target. So something else was going on besides the improvement of the monetary policy regime to allow this steady and maintained decline in interest rates. And what we argue was going on was a combination of globalization and demographic change, which brought about a massive underlying disinflationary adjustments. Now, as you can see from the chart on the left here, at the start of the period in 1980, the developed economies really only had their own working population, as represented by the blue line, to rely upon. But as the Iron Curtain collapsed and Eastern European countries came in, and even more important, as China came into the world's trading system with a quarter of the world's population, that meant that the available working population, which businessmen could utilize to produce goods and indeed certain services where they were mobile enough to shift the production from the high wage to the low wage economies, that effectively more than doubled the effective world's labor supply for the advanced economies in a period of not more than about 30 years. There's never been such a surge in the availability of labor supply during that period. And as can be seen from the right-hand side chart, each year, the working age population of the world was growing by hand over fist. Now, this massive increase in the availability of workers who were well organized and well educated in Eastern Europe and China had massive disinflationary effects. Not only did it lead to a relative regular decline in the prices of goods over these years, but it meant that the working age population in the developed economies was shifted from manufacturing, where they were relatively well organized and highly unionized and had quite strong bargaining strength. Into services, notably into the gig economy, where they were much less unionized and had vastly less bargaining strength than before. Effectively, that meant that with the bargaining strength of labor going down, the natural rate of unemployment declined with it, because a natural rate in some important senses makes the labor force prepared to accept the productivity increases that their own work generates. And when their bargaining power is much less, obviously they will have to accept relatively lower wages. But it was not only globalization, it was also the shift in the dependency ratio that brought about a massive reduction in the bargaining power of labor and led to disinflationary forces. In the early years, the decline in the young was not quite matched by the increase in the age, since a declining birth rate after the early 50s was not equally matched by the rise in life expectancy, which occurred steadily and longer during this period. So what we got was the decline in the number of young and the slower rise in the number of old had a number of effects. First, it enabled a much larger proportion of women to enter the labor force. Second, the working age population by definition is disinflationary, since you don't hire workers unless they're going to produce more than you actually pay them. And what's more, the workers have to save for their subsequent retirement. On the other hand, both the young and the old are essentially inflationary because they consume, but they do not produce. Increase in the number of old increases the medical costs and the social services costs of paying pensions, and the amount of care that the old are going to use because of the diseases that incapacitate them, dementia, arthritis, Parkinson's, for example, diseases, particularly in the case of dementia, which grow exponentially with old, and the ratio of the old, particularly the oldest old, are growing steadily over time, leading to a massive increased fiscal burden on our economy, and indeed a burden because of the growing need for carers. On to the next slide. Here you see the change in the dependency ratio. On the left-hand side, the red line is the advanced economies, which was declining very, very slowly until just before 2010, and is now going to rise really quite sharply with the increasing army of the aged. While the developing and the less developed economies have very improving dependency ratios, i.e. the number of dependents were declining very sharply and is now going to level out or even increase quite sharply. And on the right, I would particularly point out the yellowish dashed line, which is China, where again, a very sharp decline in the dependency ratio is going to be followed by a sharp increase in the worsening of the dependency ratio as the number of dependents increases. And that, as Manoj is going to tell you in a moment, is going to mean that China is going to move from being a very disinflationary force to being, if anything, the reverse. And what we're having is a reversal, both in globalization for political and other reasons, which the COVID pandemic is actually accelerating. One of the features of the COVID epidemic has been that with the critical medical requirements and the PPE private protective equipment, each country has looked after its own. And when it comes to the availability of the vaccine, I have no doubt that that will continue. And the combination of the greater nationalization that COVID has brought with it and the political developments, globalization is waning and dependency is going into reverse. And this is particularly true of the role of China, which has been their stunning rise over the last 30 or so years, has been effectively the main driving force of the global economy. So Manoj, over to you at this point.
Thank you, Charles. So as Charles has pointed out, we pay a lot of attention. In fact, one of the distinguishing features of the book and the work we've done on demography has been to not just pay lip service to the role of China and talk about them in a sense of an event that has already happened, but we dedicate the first chapter, in fact, of our book after the introduction to the role that China had played. As he showed you in the earlier charts, the integration of the labor force of the Chinese economy into the global system was an absolutely gigantic positive shock to global labor supply, the likes of which we think we are not likely to see ever again in the future, despite the numerical advantage that Africa and India and some countries in South America can collectively provide. So what was special about China? Well, China's labor force was clearly growing steadily, and it's starting from a very large number already, but it was the WTO accession, the internal migration in gigantic numbers from the rural areas into the urban regions on the seaboard, and the economic policy of Chinese monetary policymakers that really allowed for a gigantic transformation of the economy. Now, the effect of that was that the advanced economies did not have to invest in their own countries because a lot of the investment was shifted over to China. And this is apparent even in a phenomenon that was studied in the United States under a paper called The Surprisingly Swift Decline of Manufacturing Employment, the title of which says it all. So the difference, I think, is that we think that most of the disinflationary tailwinds through the labor supply, through the massive increase in domestic investment on its own shores, and then reshipping of cheap goods back into the advanced economies, most of that seems to be behind us. Today, we've got three issues that differentiate China from the past. First, we believe that the most beneficial part of the internal migration is probably over, which means China is now past what we would call the Lewis point, which means that future migrations don't come with a much greater benefit than cost and have to be considered very, very, very realistically. Second, and this is very clear from the multiple lawsuits and the blockages that administrations have put on, but the overall environment for capital flows itself, the inflow of companies and hence the Western technologies of management and capital that were brought along with those companies into China is now much slower, much harder. In fact, as Charles pointed out, part of the problems with this inward-looking strategy that the COVID pandemic has put upon us, one of the trends that we are seeing in Asia is a real question mark around whether people want to deploy a different supply chain besides China. And the economic model and the environmental, external environment have both been transformed as a result. So Chinese policymakers themselves want to move to what they call a consumption-led growth model. It's not something that we argue is realistic in an economic sense, more a mathematical transformation. But the result of all of that is threefold. First is that the larger effects of disinflation through the labor force and this massive influx of capital and investment means that China is already moving on from becoming a disinflationary force and into probably a mildly inflationary one. Second, we are likely to see, like in many other economies that are aging, falling savings as the Chinese economy ages, and that will push into deficit the current account. That will have profound effects not only within China, but also on the current accounts of a lot of the commodity producers, particularly in the Middle East. And finally, China, as you can see, partly because of the trade war, partly because of this inward-looking policy, is having to work very, very, very hard. It is determined, but it has to work a lot harder for the technological change to be generated at home, which means a slower implementation of new production and a much smaller disinflationary story that it can place at the feet of the global economy. But that role having been changed, I think the rest of the world also looks like it's in for a very different path up ahead. And to deal with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Charles.
Thank you very much. The first point that I would like to make is that this switch from the high wage to the low wage economies has actually reduced world inequality, as Balinovich has actually pointed out. There are many more Chinese than there are Americans, and the ratio of wages in China to the ratio to America has moved dramatically in favor of the Chinese, as is an example in the ratio of wages in Eastern Europe to Western Europe, though not nearly such a dramatic change. I'm from about 1800 until about 2010, until about 1990. The economies of Europe and of North America and of Australasia bounded ahead, while the economies of Asia, Middle East, and Africa more or less stagnated. And that meant that world inequality increased because inequality between countries increased so dramatically. From about 1980 onwards, that began to narrow, and now we've actually seen a reduction in world inequality. Nevertheless, of course, the reduction in world inequality went hand in hand with an increase in within-country inequality virtually everywhere, as you would expect if you had a massive increase in the availability of labor, because the effect of a massive increase in the availability of labor, particularly low-wage labor, meant that anyone who had access to capital, whether physical capital or human capital, managerial expertise, technological expertise, going to do dramatically well. And the reduction in manufacturing and sort of medium skilled work in the Western economies went hand in hand with the reduction in the strength and bargaining power of private sector trade unions, whose membership steadily declined after about 1980. And is still on a declining path. And the increase in inequality is simply a symptom. It recurs as a result of the demographic and globalization changes we've talked about. And since the globalization and demographic changes are about to reverse, so we think the inequality will. And here again, you see the figure from Oktor, the American economist, showing that the higher the degree of human capital that workers have, the dark blue line, the graduate degree, the better off you have been over the last 60 or so years. And this is particularly so after the 1980s, when China and Eastern Europe really kicked in. And in a sense, this was an inevitable consequence of the prior trends and the massive supply, upwards positive supply shock to the labor force that we saw. Can we have the next slide, please? The result is...
Can you just go a little bit back, because once you come closer to the mic, it, so if you can just lean back a bit, maybe it's...
I'm too close, am I?
Okay. Yeah, that's much better. Thank you. So if you stay away, that's better. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, what has happened is that the Gini coefficients in virtually every country in the world, with the exception of Turkey, have actually been worsening over this period, notably in the USA and in the Scandinavian countries. So can we go on, please? And the other particular problem, which I've already mentioned, is that the proportion of the really old is going to grow as the fastest growing part of our total population in the future. These figures are in the UK, and they're going to grow. This is the growth that there's going to be from 2017 to about 2035. The growth of the oldest old is going to grow by about 78%, and almost double. The growth of the old is going to go by 50%. And they are, as I've said before, very expensive. And the effect of that on the fiscal position is really fairly dramatic. Now, these figures come from before the COVID pandemic. These figures are from the Office of Budget Research in 2018, showing that the baseline projections of the primary deficit, the purple, and the public sector net debt, the yellow line. So even before the COVID pandemic occurred, we were running into a seriously worsening debt deficit situation. Also at this stage, I'd like to mention one other feature, which is that the regrowth of the working population is slowing down. It's going to actually decline in many of the countries where world growth was highest. Now, the regrowth of GDP is a factor of two combined forces, the rate of growth of the working population and the rate of growth of productivity per head of that working population. Now, the rate of growth of the working population is slowing down or even declining, as it will be in Germany, China, much of Europe, then unless we have a productivity miracle, we are actually going to get a much slower growth of GDP. So the idea that we can grow out of our debt, unless you get a miracle, or unless there is some extraordinary medical breakthrough in dealing with the basic incapacitating problems of dementia and Parkinson's for the old, it's not going to happen. And this is the same picture of the federal debt held by the public in the US. And again, this is prior to COVID. So the situation in terms of debt is even more dramatically difficult than it was before. Can we go on to the next one? Next slide. Now, can I turn over to Manoj again to go through the mitigants of this? Actually, before I turn over, I'd like to just go over one particular area of discussion. And that is that many people to whom we set out the data on demography and globalization do accept that the reversal of these underlying trends will at some stage lead to what we worry about, more inflation, higher nominal interest rates, waning of inequality, some increase in productivity, et cetera, et cetera. But they say that this will come very slowly and it won't be a problem for quite a long period of time. And indeed, before the COVID pandemic came about, we ourselves were very uncertain about how quickly these reversal of these underlying important trends would actually take hold. And we were not at all clear to within plus or minus at least 5 years of when this would come. We do, however, believe that the COVID pandemic will actually accelerate the process. There are others who think that the reverse, because they point to the disruptions and the need for adjustment and the likely increase in unemployment. We, on the other hand, would point to the massive increase in monetary expansion that has taken place, with the American money supply rising at 30% per annum. Never in its history has the American US money supply risen at anything like this rate. And also the fragility and the overhang of debt of the private sector corporation is going to mean that they're going to have to raise their markups in order to try to survive. Over the next few years, companies, the main aim for companies is going to be survival rather than growth. And as a result, they're going to have to be forced to raise their markups as far as they can. Now, with that, I'm going to hand back to Manoj to go through the various mitigants and arguments that have been raised against our thesis. So Manoj, back to you.
Thanks, Charles. So the interesting thing about going through this argument is that when we initially start with a backward-looking explanation of this global labor supply shock and the disinflationary impact of China, I think most people do not have major disagreements with us, because history has been very well charted. And the connection between demography and inflation is fairly clear for everyone to see. The interesting part of the story is when we talk about a reversal of these underlying factors of demography, the agreement stops right there and then. And in a normal world, it would be incumbent upon those who disagree or think that the connection of the past no longer holds to explain their position. But such is the entrenched conventional wisdom that it has been left to us to argue that what happened in the past is a connection that does not need severing. However, there are five key arguments that people make about why we could be wrong and why things could change. The first of these is, as I mentioned, the numerical advantage that Africa and India have as far as demography is concerned. In those countries, the dependency ratios and indeed the working age population are going to show a huge numerical advantage for many years and in some cases, many decades going forward. So why can't we think of using those populations in order to compensate for the aging that is happening in the rest of the world? Well, there are two or three problems here. The first one, as Charles mentioned, is that the issue is that the demography headwinds that we are likely to see over the next 20 or 30 years are happening primarily in those economies that have thus far been providing the overwhelming bulk of global growth for the last few decades. To suddenly transform the world economic landscape think that Africa and India are suddenly going to start producing so much that they can offset everything else in the advanced economies in Eastern Europe and in North Asia seems very, very, very optimistic to us. Second, it's very difficult to think that we can import the labor forces from these countries into the advanced economies to create a perfect numerical offset at home. The current political climate will simply not allow that. And so the third option is, well, why not take physical capital into those countries, transform it into goods and services, and then ship those goods and services back to the advanced economies, as China did? That is a viable solution in theory, but in practice, I think the problems are that these countries collectively and certainly individually do not have the administrative capital that China did. And they also do not have the historical organization of guilds, the passing through of knowledge, the formulation of the economy, which has kept China at the forefront of history for most of history. So they will do extremely well. We are very positive about the fortunes of Africa and India over the coming decades. But do they have the ability to offset what is happening in the rest of the world? We are very skeptical about that. The second issue is, well, if the two charts that Charles showed you on how debt is going to rise exponentially in some cases as the process of aging hits us, if that is the key problem, why not benefit why not limit the benefits to the old? In some senses, this has been happening already. And one of the effects of that has been that if you look at this very important cohort of the 55 to 64 year olds in the advanced economies, the participation rates of those workers has gone up substantially as they have realized that they're going to have to work a lot harder for a lot longer because their pension benefits have been limited. So in some senses, you have already squeezed that to a large extent. But keep in mind that the difference between the young and the old is a political one. The old vote, and they will not allow administrations to come into power who completely do away with the benefits. Yes, some erosion is inevitable, but it's very unlikely that any significant chopping of the benefits to the old, whether it's pensions or it's medical help, will be allowed. Third, well, that should mean that the elderly should participate more. As I said, some of this has already happened. In fact, if you look at the participation ratios in the advanced economies, they have been rising for the over 65s for the last 20 years. So this is not something they don't understand. But even then, if you look at the difference between the retirement age, the effective retirement age, not the legal one, and life expectancy has exceeded that effective retirement age in a very steady and aggressive fashion. So it's something that in principle works, but the extent to which this can offset demography and its headwinds is very difficult to see. And so that brings us to the final two and key objections, after which I will conclude. First is technology, and the second one is Japan. Now, on technology, we have a argument that actually comes as a surprise to some people. We are depending on technology getting rid of repetitive jobs. We depend on the manufacturing sector releasing enough workers, because what the numbers from the UN population statistics and the dire demography numbers that Charles showed you earlier do not include is that an increasingly large part of the labor force will have to be dedicated to looking after the elderly. Now, this is what Charles and I call socially productive work, but it is not economically productive in the classic sense, because the services that are being produced by these carers will be used once, and the people who consume those services will not go on to produce anything else in the future. So this is not something that we can move away from, which means we need more and more jobs that are repetitive in nature to be shut down permanently, which will allow a reallocation of labor into the services sector where they can look after the elderly. So rather than worrying about whether we will run out of jobs, we are hopeful that we will actually continue to destroy jobs. As Charles puts it, the key question that people ask us is, why can't the robots simply look after the elderly? I like quoting him because he puts it very eloquently when he says, the problem is one of emotional support. And robots, as he correctly says, have an emotional quotient of exactly zero. That's not something that we think will really change going forward either. If it does, we'll be very happy to take a look at that. And that brings me to my final point. The biggest question we get asked, and we have an entire chapter dedicated to this, is if aging is inflationary, why did it not happen in Japan? Japan is at the forefront of demography. It has started aging well before everyone else by a significant amount. And yet we have not seen inflation. We have not seen interest rates rise. So why does your thesis not work there? Well, the simplest point to make is it's very difficult to think that Japan is an economy operating under autarky, that it's a completely closed off economy. And hence whatever happens with its labor force will dictate everything. Unfortunately, that is exactly the model that is usually applied to Japan. Or put another way, think of it this way. How could Japan have inflated when China was deflating the entire world at exactly the time that Japan's labor force started shrinking? Okay, and three things in Japan need to be carefully looked at. Number one, as Charles said, productivity did change. And Japan has actually delivered the kind of productivity that most advanced economies would bite your hand off for. They had 1% growth while the labor force was contracting by 1%. And the difference between the two is a 2% productivity rise, which is not being matched by almost every large advanced economy. Second, rather than being a closed economy, what people miss, and this is something that we have added to the literature, something you'll see more from us, through 20 years of data from METI, Japan's industry for economic transformation of its industry, what you see is Japan Incorporated actually realized that China was there, that it was providing a massive labor supply shock to the rest of the world, and it realized that labor was cheap elsewhere. So it produced goods and services in an increasing proportion outside. So if you look on the lower left-hand side, the overseas to domestic capital investment, manufacturing, employment, all these ratios rose significantly because Japan Incorporated decided that looking outside was far more profitable. In fact, the Japanese corporate sector, seen in this light, is a very dynamic entity and not at all the bogged down version of indebtedness that most people painted out to be. And finally, if you look at Japan's labor market, something that is, again, quite well known, we all know that it has its own peculiar characteristics. But what happened in there was a threefold adjustment. Number one, what the firms did was they adjusted hours rather than wages, and the employment remained steady. Second, the Japanese labor force increasingly moved from manufacturing into services. And third, Japanese companies increasingly used part-time workers instead of full-time workers, because part-time worker wages could be manipulated in a way that could not be done for full-time workers. In conclusion, I just wanted to wrap up and turn it back over to you, Simeon. We think inflation is coming. As Charles has said, the coronavirus will accelerate its arrival. One of the key things that we want to push forward over here is, while monetary factors are clearly important, many of the reasons that we have provided for a revival of inflation are actually real, not monetary. And that is the way the structural transformation could work. Second, real interest rates could rise, but we think they are far more likely to rise with a steepening of the yield curve. Central banks are more likely, as Charles said, to allow companies with large corporate debt ratios to protect themselves by keeping interest rates low as far as they can. And with rising inflation, that will mean that real interest rates at the front end could go lower still. That may happen even at the long end if there is yield curve control, but that will simply become a pro-cyclical move to push inflation even higher. Under those conditions, asset returns will be much harder to extract for financial markets. And the combination of all of this will mean that even within country inequality will start falling. There will be some issues. The debt trap will have to be dealt with, as Charles was talking about. Some of the financing of age-related expenditure will happen with taxes, and it will be particularly interesting with the US elections on the 3rd of November. And finally, this great romance or friendship between central banks and fiscal policymakers will probably reach a very, very rocky conclusion, where finance ministers will increasingly put pressure on central banks to keep interest rates low, and central banks will have to find some way to deal with higher inflation and the pressure from fiscal policymakers. Unfortunately, we believe that it's the fiscal side of the story that will win out, and central bank independence will come under increasing threat. But that's it from both of us. Simeon, let me turn it back to you at this stage.
Thank you very much to both of you. I'll start with some questions that already came through the chat. A historical question, or actually a set of questions for Charles, relating mostly, as I understand, to the first graph. So Charles, you showed us this first graph that interest rates were remarkably stable until relatively recently, then they went up, and now as you say, seem to have been in decline. So three related questions to that. One is, can you comment on Paul Schmelzing's theory of Rio, or actually not just theory, but also observation, that real interest rates have actually been declining over a long period of time, real interest rates. Your comment on that, financial repression before World War II. So that seemed to be a period of relatively stable interest rates. Does it have to do with financial repressions? And can you actually talk more generally about financial repression beyond that period? And somewhat related, I guess, the gold standard. So did the gold standard play a significant role in this remarkable stability that you showed us? And then hence the absence of this relating to the more recent instability. And the first question to Manoj is pension reform. So you spoke a lot about various aspects of demography, the fact that there is a big pressure on the 55 to 64 year olds to either rejoin or stay longer or work harder in the labor market. Do you see a significant wave of pension reforms coming as a way to both make mandatory pensions longer, but also to incentivize more people? And perhaps related to that, to both of you, tax reform. So again, you mentioned at the end of your presentation, Manoj, and Charles mentioned in passing that there need to be some significant changes to adjust basically to this dynamics. In your book, more specifically, how do you treat coming tax reforms? But maybe start with Charles and the historical aspects of Rio or in general interest rates, then pension reform, and then tax reform while we wait for the other many questions that seem to be coming as I speak. Charles.
Can you hear me?
Can you hear? Yes, we can hear.
Of course, I've got a little sign saying my speaker's not working. Let me remind you that in the 19th century and before, lending to governments was regarded as rather risky. Governments normally borrowed for wartime purposes, and when they got defeated, they often didn't pay back. Governments traditionally were actually rather risky borrowers who forced lenders to pay for them. The number of occasions when kings and governments failed to repay were quite large. And what we actually have are data on government debt. So that what you see in the reduction in real interest rates over time is quite largely a reduction in actually the risk premium of lending to the government. Whereas so lending to the government went from being relatively risky to being now regarded as completely safe. And that will have reduced the interest rates over time. Real interest rates have certainly varied a great deal, but I would argue that the longer term over centuries decline in the general level of real interest rates is a risk premium effect rather than anything else. The second question was, might we have more repression, financial repression? And the answer is to that one would be yes, if the governments could do it. And the reason that the governments will find difficulty in doing that is that financial repression requires exchange control, preventing your population from investing abroad. And I think that in this day and age, it will be pretty difficult for most governments to reintroduce exchange controls once they've got rid of them. I don't regard it as beyond question that some governments, even current advanced economies, may reintroduce exchange controls, but it's not on the horizon yet. And finally, the gold standard. Yes, the gold standard had a lot to do with the stability of prices and nominal variables during these earlier centuries. But that was at the expense of making governments unable to manage the finances as easily as they could. And I think, again, under modern political circumstances, the idea that governments will willingly constrain their own ability to, let's put it bluntly, rely on the inflation tax and monetizing if they need to, that they just won't do it. So my argument is, yes, the gold standard had a lot to do with price stability, but the modern political conditions make it totally non-feasible to go back in that way. And I'm not sure that I would welcome and recommend governments disposing of their ability to use the monetary variable and the inflation tax if they need it as such. So
thank
I think
I'll jump in quickly.
Please do.
I'll jump in quickly for the pension reforms. I think there is more coming. There is more pension reform coming. What we are seeing is the beginning of these pressures on the government budgets, and those have been exacerbated much further by the coronavirus pandemic. You've seen all these debt numbers rise increasingly, and that will mean that the questions about sustainability of this debt won't be just a matter of looking at Brazil's 100% debt to GDP and wondering how they can be repaid. Even with high per capita GDPs in the advanced economies, when the obligations to the elderly become apparent, there will have to be some way of reducing the obligations and passing them on to the elderly. Our point is that this will happen to some extent, but cannot be done to an extent that completely absolves the government of its responsibility and therefore shifts the burden of saving onto people, because this is a political question. If the elderly were not allowed to vote and we did not have democratic systems, this could have been done in a probably a more judicious or expedited manner. But because these processes are very difficult to deal with, it's simply not politically possible to get ahead with them. As again, at those points that Charles has made is, even if you look at Russia, where President Putin has enjoyed a great amount of popularity, raising the pension age has been hard. You've seen that it's taken riots in Greece to actually pass higher pension age reforms. And yet the increase in life expectancy over the effective pension age has gone up in a straight line for the last few decades. So I think the amount of catch up that could be done by reducing some of those pension benefits is very low. On tax reforms, I think the most interesting point from everyone else's perspective that we have made has been on equity finance. But that is Charles's baby, and I'll turn it back over to him if you don't mind.
No, great. So Charles, maybe a bit broader on tax reform, or maybe you can start with equity and then a bit broader on tax reform, because we have a number of questions as to what comes out in terms of government policies, given what you've just told us, and probably tax is a significant part of it, I assume. Charles.
I think tax reform will have to come, but there are limits to tax reform, and increasing taxes is politically extremely unpopular. So that if you're thinking of the attempt by politicians to maximize the likelihood of re-election, I'd have thought that allowing, almost encouraging, a degree of relatively minor inflation, by which I mean something of around 4 to 5%, will, to them, be more attractive than trying to raise taxes even further. And taxes on the wealthy inevitably have majority support, but the wealthy are more mobile than the poor. And if you try and raise taxes too much, the wealthy leave. And it has very considerable disadvantages in meaning that those who are frequently have the highest human capital and the most dynamic actually leave your country. One of the areas that we think is ripe for a greater taxation is urban land values. Virtually a massive proportion of bank lending is collateralized on the basis of exactly such values. And if you were to increase any such taxation at all quickly or in a jump, it would probably bring about a collapse of your financial and banking system. So there are strict political and other constraints and frictions about any really major increase in taxation. which is again one of the reasons why we think that it is quite likely, should these inflationary pressures take hold, that there will be a very considerable likelihood of inflation rising. The great question to our minds is not will inflation rise, but will it be possible to hold it at reasonably acceptable levels?
Thank you, Charles. Two questions, more specific questions. One from Stefan Collignon. So you seem to suggest that the return on capital will fall in the future. If so, what does this mean for pension systems? Capital base versus pay as you go? That's one question. And a separate question, I guess, to both of you, but maybe more to Charles. So is it correct to think that you're suggesting that for central banks that do inflation rate targeting, the correct inflation rate in the future would be more like 4 to 5% rather than the 2% that some countries are that some central banks are following? Did you hear that, Charles?
Yeah, I'd rather Manoj took the first question on pensions.
Can you take it? I'll take it, Charles. So I think one of the points that we are trying to make over here is it's not clear to us that the return on capital necessarily has to fall. One of the points we are trying to make over here is that part of the reason that inequality has come up is because the global surge in labor over the last 30 or 35 years has meant that the corporate sector has enjoyed a tremendous amount of profitability with very little effort required. And it was not in their interest, from profit-seeking institutions' point of view, to really get involved very heavily in capital investment. A lot of what has happened over the last few years and probably even decades is that intangible capital has increased at the expense of tangible capital, and that has seen transformation of the weight even in the equity market. Going forward, what we think is likely to happen is the coronavirus pandemic is already accelerating the desire of companies who can switch away from labor in order to protect their supply chain and future production towards slightly more capital and certainly more intangible capital. So their incentives to invest more come about not only as a function of what we're seeing in the pandemic, but also the expected contraction and lack of availability of labor in the future. So we are more optimistic on productivity. We are more optimistic that as time goes by, companies will try and raise the return on capital to protect themselves. The companies that don't do that will see a shrinking share of the pie. And that should somewhat offset some of the pressures that you see on pensions. But again, like the earlier questions, I don't think it's quite enough to do enough. I mean, it won't be to an extent that we get rid of all our problems. As Charles said very early on, we're expecting productivity to rise, but not by a miraculous rate. I mean, even what Japan achieved, 2%, is a really, really, really good number if we can achieve that. We're not quite sure where we'll get to. Certainly not to a point where the pension system needs to not worry about anything.
Could I,
perhaps add that the pensioners are already under great pressure because of the very, very low rates of interest? And can I go further and sort of turn to the argument about the inflation target? My view, though we don't actually say this in the book anywhere, is that the disinflationary trends from globalization and demography over the last 30 years have been so great that it would actually have been much more sensible if central banks had had an inflation target of zero rather than 2%. And trying to get a inflation target of 2% has forced them to lower interest rates continuously. And the decline in interest rates has been so much that it has actually led to a great incentive to raise debt. And that combined with the tax advantages of debt has led to one of the factors leading to this massive increase in debt and the increase in leverage, both in the private and in the public sectors. And it has been, in effect, disguised, if you can call it that, by the continuing downwards trend in interest rates, because debt service ratios have not increased at all as a proportion of GDP. In fact, they've actually gone down in most countries slightly over these last 30 years. But we've now reached the point at which it's actually now physically impossible for interest rates to fall much further. And if inflation rises and with it nominal interest rates, the outcome is going to be a great deal more difficult. And it would be lovely if we were wrong, because if interest rates do have to rise, unless you get a rise of inflation instead, which is very likely, then life is going to be a great deal more difficult than it has been in the past, much more difficult. We are effectively warning people that the future holds a great deal more difficulties, and that one, but only one, of the adjustments that needs to be made is to try and shift the advantages of financing away from debt back towards equity finance through a variety of routes, through fiscal routes of various kinds, reducing the tax advantages of debt, maybe increasing the burden on debt finance through fiscal measures once leverage rises above a certain level, and taking whatever steps one can to encourage management to finance through greater equity rather than debt. And that leads on to a proposal that Rosa Lastra and I have advanced, whereby the internals, i.e. senior management, no longer have the advantage of limited liability, which would make them much more prepared to undertake equity safe finance rather risky, but equity return maximizing debt finance.
And Charles, one more, well, not really related, but central banking. So given what you've told us and what you've written in the book, is central bank independence more at risk in the future than it has been over the last 20, 30 years? You're one of the founders of independent central banking in the UK. Do you see, because of these pressures that you've just mentioned, a move away from independent central banking?
I fear that the answer is yes, but not immediately. Because there has been the undershoot of the 2% target, and I think that it was, as I say, looking at it with hindsight, it was a mistake to have a 2% target rather than a 0% target. This is going to mean that over the next couple of years, when we do, as we expect, get higher inflation, central banks will initially welcome this and say that this is simply reversing the undershoot that there was before. Average inflation targeting is the sort of the jargon phrase for what they'll be using. It won't be until that has occurred for sufficiently long for there to be no more ability to claim that this is merely averaging out past undershoots. And if inflation continues as we believe, then what will happen? And because of the fragility and the debt burden that we have, we think that politicians will put great pressure on central banks to accept, at any rate, a somewhat greater modicum of inflation. The question is not whether they will accept it, but whether they can actually hold it at that level. If central banks insist on trying to hold to 2%, then I raise the question that emperors raised about the Pope. How many divisions does the chair of the central bank governing council actually have?
Very apt. A number of questions are now starting to come towards Manoj first. So you mentioned in one of your slides that you anticipate, as we understand it, a reduction in inequality within countries, within some countries or a larger group of countries. Can you explain a bit of that? And then towards, while you're doing this, towards Charles, a comment from Antonio Foglia from Italy. Italy has similar demographics to what you've just shown, Charles, but no increase in productivity, no inflation, not much happening. So maybe you can reflect on what if there is no increase in productivity and inflation. But first, Manoj, please, equality.
Sure. So part of the devil's bargain over the last 20 or 30 years is that we had a very prosperous scenario for asset owners. Home ownership has gone up. Interest rates have fallen, and that fall in interest rate has allowed both private and public debt issuers to finance their borrowing at an increasingly cheap rate. So even though the overall leverage in the system has gone up, the cost of that leverage, or the cost of servicing that leverage, has gone down. And that has allowed a huge buildup in house ownership. It's built up a huge buildup in overall government debt. The corporate sector is indebted, so on and so forth. The downside of all of that has been that the benefits of these developments over the last 30 years have gone to those who own capital. While as the charts Charles showed you, the huge labor supply shock that pushed inflation down disproportionately affected workers in the advanced economies at the lower level of human capital and educational attainment, because those are the ones that were competing with places like China and emerging markets, where some of that lower end production could be shifted. So the effect of rising asset prices, which in itself was a result of the decline in interest rates, and the effect of offshoring of a lot of the production, which was an effect of this huge surge in global labor supply and a relocation of investment to China and other emerging market economies, is what led to the overall increase in within country inequality. Simeon, as you were very clear in pointing out, this is a within country inequality story, because over the last few decades, across country inequality, as Charles pointed out, and Milanovic also has actually fallen. What is likely to change now is that as inflation rises, and we have less conviction in where real interest rates go, but we believe that even that may have a little less downside than many are anticipating, at least as far as the equilibrium real interest rate is concerned. The change in the global labor supply will make the wage bills of the corporate sector rise. That means the corporate sector will have to work increasingly hard to protect its profitability. The result will be higher productivity, which is, by the way, the only way the higher wage growth can be sustained over a period of time. But all of that, the difficulty in generating rapid increases in asset prices, the increasing inflation, which will dilute the profit margins that the corporate sector could have, which will raise interest rates and make asset prices harder to push up. All of that should lead to a change in the trends of the last 30 years. The labor force will be able to protect itself because its bargaining position will go up. If taxes are used to finance of the age-old related higher after-tax wages, the increase in productivity will allow them to have a sustained increase in wage growth. And at the same time, the owners of capital will find returns increasingly hard to come by. The combination of all of that is likely to be a reversal of the last 30 or 35 years and a decrease in that within country inequality that we've seen. That's I think, the broad thesis that we are pushing.
Thank you very much. So Charles, let me slightly expand on the Italy question. So not much productivity, but no inflation. Is this because of Eurozone? And if that's the case, the second part, if so, how does the Eurozone or other arrangements that play a role in determining interest rates, how does that jive with the analysis that you've presented to us?
Well, I think that Italy had a particularly adverse effect from the rise of China, because they in Italy were producing goods, quite largely luxury consumer type goods, which the low wage Chinese were able to provide cheap but very good substitutes. Whereas Germany actually benefited because they were producing the kind of investment goods, manufacturing the capital equipment which China needed. So Germany got a complementary benefit from China, whereas Italy got a very rough and hard substitution effect. Now, if China is going to reverse, as we think, quite severely, quite strongly, that's going to mean that the adverse trends affecting Italy and the beneficial effects on Germany are going to be less. And in the meantime, Italy did, as you pointed out, Simeon, give up its ability to control its own monetary system when it joined the euro system. And the euro system has been run largely to achieve an overall effect in which the Northern Europeans had a very large sort of weight. And that has led, caused, for the reasons we know and understand, made it very difficult for Italy and other Southern European countries to adjust to the financial bust that occurred in 2007-2009. We think that this will in turn reverse. As you probably saw in the papers, there was it was noted a couple of days ago that the German population, that's the overall population, was beginning to decline, and their working age population will be declining even faster. And that, unless there is a massive increase in immigration, which remains politically unpopular there as much as elsewhere, is going to mean that the increase in inflationary pressures in Germany will start rising to match the inflationary pressures elsewhere. So I think that the divergent trends that we've had between Southern and Northern Europe over the last 20 years, particularly over the last 10 years, may themselves reverse over the course of the next 10 to 20 years. So I'm more optimistic about Italy than perhaps some of the Italians themselves.
Very good. So we're optimistic about Italy. It's one take from this. Price of commodities. I'm going now through some other questions. So what happens to the prices of commodities given the story that you've painted for us? So lower growth of China on the one hand that you mentioned. On the other hand, you're talking about high inflation in the future. So what happens to the prices of the main commodities and resulting from this to the countries that depend a lot on these commodities? So would, in other words, global inequality rise because some countries that depend on particular commodities will suddenly experience a lot slower growth? Any of you?
I'm one of the things that we didn't deal with, because you can't deal with everything, is climate change. And a combination of climate change and slower growth is undoubtedly going to mean that the demand for oil is not going to rise very sharply, so that oil prices will not rebound greatly after as all this takes place. If anything, they may go down in the longer run. But for the other commodities, a slower world growth overall is likely to mean for a somewhat lower rate of growth of commodities overall, but probably not as dramatic as in the case of fossil fuels. And that, of course, is going to mean that the oil-producing countries will no longer be running the surpluses that they had in the past. And again, the world's international sort of current account picture is going to change dramatically. And in the past two or three decades, the great surplus countries have been China, Germany, and the oil-producing states. In all three cases, we think their surpluses are going to disappear like the autumnal leaves. And so that the future sort of balance of current account surpluses and deficits around the world is going to change dramatically. But quite how, I think it's very hard to see where which countries in future will run such large surpluses, except perhaps Africa.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to put out. The second point to keep in mind, I think, from here is that there isn't that much surprise when you talk about low commodity prices in the future. I mean, in the last presidential debate, when Mr. Biden had argued that they are going to transition away from oil, something that he walked back later on, the surprise factor actually wasn't as big as you had seen with Al Gore's comments on coal quite a while ago. It isn't the same thing anymore. I think the trickier factor for the oil producing countries is going to be twofold. Number one is in most of them, you have seen an investment recession, including Norway, including Canada, Brazil, all of them have pared back significantly on future investment plans when it comes to capacity in the oil producing sector. The issues are, I think, where the break-even price of oil, as far as the fiscal numbers are concerned, is particularly high in the Middle East. Many countries over there, to balance their budgets, require something like $80 or $100 oil, and that's simply not going to come ahead. So as the current account surpluses of places like China transform themselves into deficits, the pressure that they're going to put on some of these oil exporting countries are going to lead to extraordinary changes in their debt profile and how people think about risk premium there. I think that's a real challenge that we will see on an economic basis for commodity exporters, particularly those with budgets that have taken for granted that high oil prices are here to stay.
Thank you to both. A question returning to the topic of equity finance versus debt finance. The question is, we've seen in the past decades socializing of the losses of large banks, too big to fail banking, including in the previous crisis in the UK and elsewhere. If that continues, the incentives to shift towards more equity finance are somehow not that high. Can you comment on that, or in general, what would corporate banking or commercial banking be like in the future, given the trends that you've mentioned, and more specifically, the attitude of governments towards large commercial banks?
Well, governments have already moved quite away. I mean, the regulation has already required a great deal higher ratio of equity to debt. And the point that effectively we're making is that the change that governments pushed on banks to increase their equity ratio should actually have been undertaken much more widely. And there should have been an attempt to constrain the leverage ratios, not just of banks, but of private corporations more widely. And it will have to come. It will be difficult and it will take time. But we think that it will be inevitable as we eventually come to see the danger that allowing such much higher leverage everywhere will have led the world's capitalist system into difficulties. We're going to have to reverse that and change it.
If I may add one small point, if you look at one of the live examples of debt into equity finance and you look at China, you'll see some of the issues that they have. I think on a prospective basis, turning from debt to equity finance is easier. But when you look at China and what they're trying to achieve through debt to equity swaps, there is a complete understanding that a lot of the debt that has been issued by state-owned enterprises in the past really is not worth the notional value. And yet the willingness of both parties to accept pairing back through an equity swap is still extremely, extremely low. And the issuance of these swaps has just not gone up to the extent that most policymakers would have expected and hoped that it would. So there are problems, even when the situation is clear that the leverage has gone a long way and needs to be pared back. Some of these things will probably require more pressure, as Charles was talking about, but I think they're probably inevitable in a lot of places.
Thank you. There are two or three questions that I'm trying to group together as relate maybe to your research, which is central banking and digital currencies. I was trying to see how exactly to group them together, but it's not coming to me. Maybe the two of you have thought about these issues. So digital currencies, do they help in some of the issues that you are discussing if the central banks get into this business? Is this a central banking business in the first place? We know that there has been some discussion in the Bank of England in the last couple of years, more generally in the presidential debates. Manoj mentioned one of them, but there was a discussion of the extension of central banking around one. Can you comment at all on this issue of the future of digital currencies and to what extent they may help or are irrelevant for the trends that you discuss?
We don't really deal with that in our book at all, nor do I think that it is particularly relevant to the question of the longer run effects of the demographic and globalization trends on which we're focusing. So I would say that this is really a separate discussion about the structure and resilience of financial systems. I think that a digital currency provision by central banks will probably come. I think it's extremely unlikely that that will also entail the abolition of cash currency, because there are risks with digital cash. To begin with, the ill don't understand it and can't use it. For a second thing, it depends on the continuation of the electrical system working, and you can knock out a country's electrical system if you want to through a cyber attack, and you've got to have a fallback of a currency, cash currency system. And the Swedes, who are probably the furthest involved in produce going down towards a CBDC, will actually stockpile currency against the possibility that the digital system breaks down, which is entirely possible. I'm not saying that would happen often, but it could happen, and you need to have an alternative currency system up and running and ready to use at the same time. I think there are difficulties with the CBDC. How do you prevent a massive switch out of commercial bank deposits into CBDC the moment there's any concern about any of the banks? You can recycle it to the commercial banks, but if you recycle it, to which commercial banks are you going to send the money? And that is going to mean that the central banks will have to be even more involved than they are at the moment on assessing the solvency and the adequacy of the loan books of each of the commercial banks. So there are, the whole issue of CBDC raises the question of the relationship between the central bank on the one hand and the commercial banks on the other, a much broader or even political question that hasn't really yet been sorted out. So although I think CBDC may well come, I don't think it has actually very much to do with the kind of issues we're talking about in this book.
Thank you. Thank you, Charles. And the last question, perhaps before we conclude, goes to the shadow banking system. I read the full question. The rising debts in the past decades have been absorbed by the shadow banking system, which used them as collateral. If we assume a further growth of this shadow banking system, rising debt should not be as big of a problem as you claim. Can you say something about this? This would be the last question as well.
again, I don't think it really relates to the issues that we're talking about. Whether financing is done through the shadow banking system or through the commercial banking system, the problems of the inflationary pressures that will be brought about by demography and globalization won't actually be, in our view, that much affected. Again, it's a matter of the stability, the resilience, the structural characteristics of a world in which the banks retain their domination in Europe, or there is an increase in the shadow banking system, as is increasingly the case in North America. How far can the central banks go on successfully controlling financial stability and monetary growth? What do you mean by monetary growth in a world in which there's a greater financing through shadow banks? Again, there are many interesting questions involved, but they don't really, in our view, relate to the questions that we are focusing on in this particular book. I'm not saying the question is irrelevant. It's not. It's a very reasonable question, but it's not a question that we deal with here.
One quick thing to add is I completely agree with Charles, but one of the other things to keep in mind is that there's a huge dichotomy between the way shadow banks or the shadow banking system allocates money in economies that are well running smoothly and many economies that have significant issues with the shadow banking sector. For example, the Chinese central bank has had a 2-year long campaign against shadow banking, crushing it. And that has created significant downside to growth because these were the ones that were allocating money to individual institutions. Monetary policy, as they're finding out today, is just not equipped to hand money out to individuals. And because they've curbed the shadow banking system, they no longer have a conduit or a transmission mechanism to allocate money to small and medium enterprises. India, the other place that suffered tremendously from a overgrowth of the shadow banking system, is now pulling it back quite sharply. So while these institutions do play a very important role, it's not clear to me that they're all very well managed or allocate money just exactly the right way and hence create the kind of debt that will create no problems in the future. I think to the point that Charles was making about risk premia falling, it's something that we should keep in mind that not all shadow banks are doing exactly that. Some of them may be raising the overall risk premium of the economy.
No, excellent, excellent point. I hope that you are collecting information and thoughts about your next book, because there are certainly some questions that you know the answers and have enlightened us with this. In the meantime, your current book is already out, so our participants, now that they understand how many interesting insights are in it, please virtually run and buy it. Thank you, Charles. Thank you, Manoj. This was a wonderful, wonderful discussion. Thank you that you could share these ideas with us. And thank you to all participants. Good night, good evening, and have a good afternoon for those of us who are still in the Americas. Bye-bye, everyone.
Thank you, Simeon.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.